Hello, and welcome back to the 3 a.m. Mystery Club. This is Brandon, and with me are my partners in true crime, Rowena and Derek. And it's good to be back. We took a little breather. We hope you guys didn't miss us too bad, but we really needed the time, and it's paid off. We're ready to get back in the swing of things. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing great, but I just have to say, I really hope you did miss us.
Let us know if you did. So it's my turn tonight. And since it's Friday, I've got a story that's not exactly a mystery for you, but it's a story that's always fascinated me. I think some of you may not have heard of it. And if you have, I hope that you like my telling and our take on it. It was a beautiful August day in 1963, still 3 months away from November 22nd, the day that the world would stop everything and mourn the untimely death of a young president. It was that August day, the 28th to be exact, that 21-year-old Janice Wiley and 23-year-old Emily Hoffert were brutally murdered in their apartment in New York's fashionable Upper East Side. The nation would be captivated by the story of two young career girls' lives being so viciously cut short. It wasn't until that November day when the nation and newspaper front pages shifted their attention from one tragedy to another. This is the story of the career girl murders. But let me start by saying again, this is not an unsolved crime. There are no real mysteries, but it's one that has always stuck in my head, and it's a story from my favorite era in history. There's nothing more interesting to me than the innovative fashions, the architecture, music, and yes, the murders of the 1960s. For me, the 1960s crime starts with the career girl murders and ends with the Manson family murders. And even though the landscape changed drastically in the 6 years between those two sensational crimes, I think they bookend the 60s perfectly. The career girl murders happened at a time when the nation still had an ugly innocence. Americans still swept all the bad stuff under the rug. Music and fashion were even tidy. But then war broke out and young people discovered protesting. Music and fashion became gritty. The summer of love birthed a new generation. And on August 8th and 9th, 1969, Charles Manson sent his followers on a mission. In just 6 years, so many things changed in the United States, but the brutality and senselessness of these murders defied the times. In the early 1960s, thousands of women turned their backs on the outdated notion that a woman should settle down right away. Instead, many of them left their small towns and headed to New York City and other large cities to seek jobs and careers. Think Peggy Olson of Mad Men. And speaking of Mad Men, in one of their earlier episodes, you can actually hear the details of this case playing in the background of a scene. It wasn't part of a storyline, but it was part of the brilliant background of the show, much like the fashions and furnishings. Those tiny little tidbits are what really kept me going back to the show. But don't let me digress too much. So Janice Wiley and Emily Hoffert were real-life Peggy Olsons. Emily had left her home in Minneapolis, Minnesota, a little more than a month before the murders, to begin her teaching career on Long Island. Sadly, it was such a short time in the city, she didn't even get to start her job. Janice lived a more charmed life. She was the daughter of Max Wiley, a writer and radio and television producer and director. He actually created and wrote the show The Flying Nun, starring Sally Field. So needless to say, Janice's family wasn't very supportive of their daughter when she decided she wanted to venture out on her own and join the droves of women now finding careers in the city. Janice took a job at Newsweek magazine as a researcher, or as it was known at the time, a copy girl. But stars were in the young woman's eyes as she had aspirations to become an actress on Broadway or in Hollywood. Janice and Emily shared their apartment with 23-year-old Patricia Tallis, who worked for the book division of Time Life. Janice was a society girl from a powerful family. She was blonde and bubbly, and by all accounts would have actually made a great Hollywood starlet. She was said to be very outgoing and had a number of boyfriends. Emily was the opposite of Janice. She had dark hair, was a shy academic, and much more serious. And being so new to the city, she hadn't found much time for dating. So on that flawless August day, Newsweek magazine was busier than usual. Everyone was in a frenzy covering Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Everyone was on hand at the magazine except Janice Wiley, who had failed to show up for her late morning shift. Angry coworkers did their best to cover for her, and calls to her apartment went unanswered. Later that day, roommate Patricia returned home from work and found their apartment had been ransacked and was covered in blood. After going from room to room, Patricia found her two roommates lying on the floor of one of the bedrooms. Both were lifeless and covered in their own blood. Janice and Emily had been stabbed at least 63 times. The damage to the bodies was so extensive, it wasn't possible for the coroner to get an exact count of the wounds. The killer had also used several knives in the attack, as investigators found several broken blades in and near the bodies. Janice, who was found wearing only a towel, had also been sexually assaulted. From the looks of the brutal attacks, investigators first thought they had to know their attacker. That level of violence is usually an indication that a victim knew, you know, who was doing this to them. A crime of passion, as it's often called. There were also no signs of forced entry, which usually means the attacker was willingly led into the place. And despite the apartment being ransacked, there seemed to be nothing missing. So robbery was definitely not the motive. So it makes sense why police would assume the victims, or at least one of them, knew the assailant. Police were so certain of this, they first focused their time interviewing the men from Janice's green little address book. However, the investigation turned up nothing for the first several months. And as I mentioned previously, John F. Kennedy's assassination that November distracted people from the case. It took another 8 months, but a suspect finally surfaced. In April 1964, Alba Barrera went to police and identified 19-year-old George Whitmore Jr. as the man who attempted to rape her a few days earlier. Whitmore was the only suspect police showed to the would-be victim. When Whitmore was arrested, police found a photo of a blonde woman in his wallet. They immediately thought the photo was Janice Wiley, so they moved Whitmore to the top of their career girl murder list. And by top, I mean, I think he was the only one. It would turn out that the photo was not of Janice Wiley, but police liked Whitmore as a suspect. It was 1963, and he was a young black man with an eighth grade education. And as investigators often do in cases like this, they find that are going nowhere. They spent 24 hours isolating and questioning Whitmore and led him right into a false confession. Whitmore was arrested for the murders and police were quick to announce they had done so. But not long after, Whitmore recanted his confession, saying police had coerced him into falsely claiming that he was the murderer of the career girls. He said they threw leading questions at him and actually beat him until he confessed. Whitmore had also not been given the chance to speak to an attorney before the extensive questioning. He was also denied a request to take a lie detector test, even though he had several people to vouch for his alibi. Despite all of this, police and prosecutors still considered Whitmore as their killer. And thankfully, Whitmore was tried twice for the crimes, and each time the verdict was thrown out because juries were found to be very impartial. It had come up that they had all been reading about the case nonstop and were pretty obsessed with it. So, there was no impartiality there. And Whitmore's treatment during his questioning would actually play a key role in the Supreme Court's 1966 5-4 ruling that requires law enforcement officials to tell those arrested of their constitutional rights, also known as the Miranda rights. So Whitmore was a free man, and he sued the city, the police department, and eventually got $500,000. Whereas I think he deserved a lot more. It was, the 1960s, so that was a pretty hefty sum. So now that Whitmore had been cleared, police didn't know where else to look. Then on October 9th, 1964, drug dealer Jimmy Delaney was arrested for the murder of a rival drug dealer. Facing the death penalty, he told police they definitely had the wrong man when they arrested Whitmore. Delaney informed police that on the day of the murders in 1963, he had met up with an old friend named Ricky Robles, who told him that he had murdered those two women in Manhattan. Robles, a young burglar, had a record of drug abuse and had been actually released from prison just 2 months before the murders. Delaney said Robles showed up at his apartment the day after the murders demanding drugs. He said Robles was covered in dried blood and was acting erratic. Police had nothing else to go on, so they trusted Delaney and eventually fit his and Robles' apartments with wiretaps. Robles, over time, talked about the details of the Career Girl murders, convincing police they finally had the real killer. Robles was arrested and charged with the murders on January 26, 1965. He was found guilty of the murders on December 1st and sentenced to life in prison. Just months earlier, New York had abolished the death penalty, except in cases of killing police officers or prison guards, so he locked out there. Delaney would eventually own up to the killings, and in a 2016 New York Post article, he detailed the crimes himself. Robles said he entered the apartment thinking it was empty. He was there hoping to steal enough money to support his heroin addiction for the day. He said Wiley then came out of the bathroom and saw him, so he attacked her. While he was assaulting her, Robles said Hoffert came in. He claims that he initially planned to let the women live, but Hoffert sealed their fates when she called him a creep and said that she would remember what he looks like and tell the police. Delaney said, quote, she said, I'm going to remember your face and tell the police and send you back to jail. I was tying them up and getting ready to leave. Emily Hoffert made a threat and I exploded. I went past my thinking centers. My mind was like a ping pong ball. I just blacked out and I panicked, end quote. Well, first of all, how did she know that he was ever in jail, but you know, to begin with? But anyway, I don't believe that quote. He said he then knocked both women out with a Coca-Cola bottle and started blindly stabbing them both.
Can I ask something?
Yes.
Did he make that up that she said that? Because how would she know that?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. That's what he told, you know, that's what he told several papers and interviews. I think he used the same quote a lot of times. I don't know if they had a conversation before where he said he just got out of jail, but I highly doubt it. So I don't think he was ever going to let him go. He just wanted, you know, even when these guys confess, they always try to soften it somehow. Like, oh, I didn't mean for that to happen, you know.
Right. He wanted some sort of an excuse to make it not seem as horrible as it was.
Right. But God, over 63 times stabbing two women.
Yeah, that's not, no.
Yeah. And thankfully, Robles has been denied by a parole board 17 times and actually remains a New York State inmate to this day. He's alive and behind bars. So one of the things I want to talk about is how these murders set back the Career Girl movement a bit. Or at least people try to use this as a reason to set it back. In a New York Times story around the time of the murders, a father from New York was quoted as saying to his 22-year-old daughter who wanted to move out on her own, yeah, you'll get an apartment in the city over my dead body. So many parents now had an actual excuse to want to keep their daughters closer to home. They seemed to think forbidding them from moving to the city would save them from harm. And in her 2011 article, The Career Girl Murders, Gender, Race, and Crime in 1960s New York, in Women's Studies Quarterly, Marilyn C. Johnson wrote that the Wiley Hoffert case served to limit the freedoms of young women and Black suspects that were so often accused in crimes against them. She wrote, quote, for young women, the discourse of crime prevention sent an unmistakably repressive message. Secure your home, limit your mobility, and seek out male protectors. Or better yet, avoiding the urban career world altogether. So even Janice Wiley's father, Max, got in on this. In 1964, he published the book Career Girl, Watch Your Step. It was a book that advised young women how to make it in the city if they were brave enough to move out on their own without the protection of men. Now, this was 1960s, and if going back to Mad Men, if you've ever seen Mad Men, then you know how it was. And they may have, you know, women were coming out of the homes and going into the office and, you know, in droves and factories also. And that's, you know, but they still weren't getting the treatment that they deserved at that time, as we all know. But thankfully, none of this ever stopped women from leaving their homes. It was just, you know, it happened at like the worst possible time, and people used it as an excuse. And I expect you to say something here.
I was waiting for the opportunity. You know, it even like when I graduated high school and I was looking at colleges and things, the college I went to for a little while was not my first choice college. I wanted to go to New York or move out west to Los Angeles or Seattle or somewhere like that. But I remember, it wasn't my mom that said it or my dad, like they were pretty supportive. But like I remember grandparents and older relatives freaking out.
People from this era.
Yeah, because they were young in that era. And so the thought of me moving somewhere like that without knowing anyone, it just scared them to death. And they were so against it. I mean, it was a lot of pushback, I remember. And even to this day, with younger people in my family, you still get the pushback, especially if you're a girl. But thankfully, you know, it's starting to open up more, and it's not as bad as it was in the 60s, but you still, as a young woman, you get a lot of pushback and you get a lot of pressure to stay in your lane, stay in your area, kind of, because people will refer to that. The first thing your grandma will say is, you're going to go there and you're going to get killed.
Yeah.
So it does have a lasting impact.
Yeah, stories like this stick with people, and much like the, you know, the gender issues, the race issues were kind of a reminder that how things have changed but haven't changed. As we all know, what's been going on the past few years, it was clear why, you know, Whitmore was charged. He was perfect for the police to just say, let's solve this case. We're going to use this guy to do it, and thankfully, you know, I didn't, you know, there was justice served. And I always find it fascinating when we're doing these cases, when I discover little things like how his situation helped bring about the Miranda rights. Like, imagine not having the Miranda rights before 1966. Like, that's crazy. You didn't have, you know, you weren't, your constitutional rights weren't given to you. You weren't offered the, you know, an attorney's help. It's so crazy when you think about not long ago the 60s were. Well, we're on like 50 years now. You know how we are with math. 50 to 60 years. It's not that long ago, but it's such a different world.
I didn't realize that was only in the 60s.
I'm glad you covered this case, because I, like you, this is one of my favorite eras to cover, just in all areas. The socioeconomics, the culture, the music, the fashion. I mean, all of it, even the crime, is fascinating to me. And this case, I actually watched it not too long ago on A Crime to Remember.
I watched that too. That's where I got the idea from.
I love that scene. But yeah, so I'm really glad you covered this, because it's a fascinating case.
Yeah, I knew you would like it. It's just like when I was reading it, I was getting goosebumps, because that means that I found, you know, the right case for me. Like, it was just like, I could almost hear the music playing, and yeah, it was a lot of fun to cover this, which, here we go again, defending ourselves. Sorry, it was fun to cover a murder story, but you know, that's what we're here for. We're here to inform and entertain and enjoy ourselves. So I shouldn't be, you know, apologizing.
You set the stage and the tone so well. I was imagining Mad Men before you even mentioned it.
And yeah.
It was overheard on Mad Men. Side note, I love when shows are that they pay that much attention to detail to have that be a part of it.
Yeah, that's my favorite thing about Mad Men. Even though I think they got one thing wrong one time, and that was the Dr. Pepper can or something was too soon. But they were so good about the details. Yeah, there's a lot of background stuff if you pay attention. Like, I remember they also talked about Marilyn Monroe's death, which was the year before.
Yeah, I was gonna mention that, and they paralleled it to Joan. And I mean, I like how they wove that stuff in there. And then a side note, when Joan started to be the script reader for the soap operas.
Oh, yes.
I was like, I would kill for that job.
Yeah, I love the 60s so much. I want to travel back. I don't want to live there, but I want to visit there.
Yes.
That's definitely where I would go if I had a time machine. And
I would too. It's fascinating.
But yeah, the 1960s murders were brutal. Like, shit was brutal then. The 60s were brutal. Like, and it's, you know, and everything. Like I said, there were so many things that were just so mild and laid back up until, you know, we know when it starts happening around 1965, 66, 67, Vietnam. And you know, the love movement, the hippie movement and counterculture and all the stuff that I love so much that ended with, you know, the Manson murders. And it's almost like things in 1970 hit, things flipped upside down and totally different. Like I remember, I'm like so rambling, but I could talk about this forever. Like 1999 to 2000 felt the same. 1969 and 1970, from what I've gathered and talked to people and read about, was like a complete change. Like clock struck midnight, 1970, like just started things over. I mean, Vietnam was still going on and, you know, nothing like that had changed, but it just fascinates me how those two decades don't cross very much. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I get what you're saying.
I don't know why, but I'm hearing a soundtrack in my head and I was imagining some Connie Francis.
Yeah. I'm hearing like, come on, people now. I can't sing or we'll get in trouble. But... No, but yeah, I love cases like this, you know, and they're easier to talk about. And had you heard about the career girls, Derek? I know Rowena has.
I mean, I've heard the term career girls. I don't know that I definitely was not familiar with the story. Yeah. But now that I've heard about it and I know that's what it's referred to as, I'm kind of wondering if maybe about it and didn't realize that's what it was.
Yeah, the tabloids, the New York tabloids, that's what they dubbed it, the career girl murders. And as part of that was, you know, stoking fear, because that's what certain newspapers and TV news now do. But yeah.
And can we just take a minute to talk about their jobs, how cool their jobs were?
Yes.
I mean, would you not love to be a researcher for Newsweek?
Yeah. As we saw on the episode of A Crime to Remember, yeah, they were like, you know, a bunch of women sitting around smoking their cigarettes. They probably had a drink in their hand and they're tearing out pages from magazines, you know, doing research for reporters. And imagine there was some fact checking and all that. But yeah, definitely much more entertaining than being a secretary at Sterling Cooper Draper yes. Price.
Now, I do wonder, though, if they had a stock room like they did at Sterling Cooper, because, you know, it was filled with cigarettes and booze and they just like along with the pens and the pencils.
Yes. Go get me some pens and some cigarettes.
And stock up for your ride home there, too.
And everything definitely smelled like cigarettes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You just dealt with it.